Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 199 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2CK exam. And this podcast is going to be relatively short and sweet. Although, again, I feel like I've said that many times, and then all these ideas keep popping in my head. And then it ends up being long. But, you know, I'll try to be as succinct as possible. So, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, and this is series 29, I believe, of the rapid review step 2 CK series, right? So this is series 29, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient and, you know, they tell you that this patient, you know, had some kind of problem that kept them in the hospital and they're intubated, mechanically ventilated. What is the best kind of nutrition you'd want to explore for those kinds of people? Well, I would hope you're thinking of pursuing enteral nutrition, right? Enteral nutrition is much better than TPN, right? Basically, if a person's bowels can move, right, you know, just go ahead and use their bowels, right? So, because the thing is, if you use a person's bowels, there are certain things that buys you. One thing it buys you is that it gives you the ability to, you know, keep their GI tracts online so it keeps working. And there's also a lower risk of infection. I mean, think about it. How many people have you ever seen have an infection from like a feeding tube, right? But TPN, you know, usually is a problem. And TPN, you can give it through like a central line or you can give it through a peripheral line. I'll encourage you to maybe go with a central line. Although, again, TPN through a central line has a pretty high risk of infection, right? Like central line associated bloodstream infections, right? So that's one very high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind on tests, right? So again, enteral nutrition is preferred, especially through a feeding tube. If that's not an option, right, then you can give TPN. But TPN, you typically give it through a central line. And it's actually very high yield to know for purposes of exams that TPN is associated with a very high risk of selenium deficiency. This is one of those weird, bizarre things you never think about for exams, and then it ends up being a very high yield, right? So TPN, selenium deficiency, and then another weird deficiency that can arise under like absurd circumstances on an MBM exam or a COMLEX exam is they can give you a question about a person that has Wilson's disease, and then they tell you that, oh, this person is getting you know, like a copriculator, you know, like trientine or like penicillamine, and then they tell you that this person has dysgeusia and this person has alopecia and is having like impaired wound healing. If you see that, think about a zinc deficiency. The thing is, when people have Wilson's disease, right, when people have Wilson's disease, they are not able to take you essentially treat them with like a copper chelator, right? You give them a copper chelator. Now, the problem with those copper chelators is they also have their, especially like trientine, so T-R-I-E-N-T-I-N-E, trientine, it's a very powerful chelator of zinc as well, right? So they can actually give you a nifty zinc deficiency question in a person that has a history of Wilson's disease that's being treated, right? So again, very high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then don't forget, right, if people have a history of Wilson's disease, you cannot give them the copper IUD. That's one high yield thing to know. And if people also have a history of like really bad bleeding, you also cannot give them the copper IUD. If people have a history of like forgetting to take their meds, you don't want to give them any kind of oral contraceptive option, right? If a person is postpartum, you don't want to give them any kind of estrogen containing contraceptive option because it will reduce the amount of protein in their milk supply, right? And then if a person has a history of you know, the person doesn't want to gain weight and they want to return to fertility real quick, you don't want to give them like the implanted medroxyprogesterone thingy that you put in the person's, like those medroxyprogesterone injections. Those are not, you know, those are typically not very ideal things for those things. And if a person has a history of osteoporosis as well, those injectable medroxyprogesterones, right, they are not good. So history of osteoporosis, doesn't want to gain weight, wants to return to fertility real quick, don't give the injectable medroxyprogesterone or whatever's. And then if a person has a history of breast cancer, right, basically the only option is a copper IUD. You cannot give, because remember, many breast cancers are ERPR positive, right? So you don't want to give them anything that like even the Mirena is not ideal in those people, right? And then if a person has a history of endometrial cancer, again, you don't want to give them unopposed estrogen. That's probably a bad idea. Probably get sued if you did that. And then if a person has like a recent history of a PID, or like some kind of like infection of the urinary the pelvic vaginal tract, right, you don't want to give those people like an IUD, right, because again, they can kind of run into trouble with those, right? And then remember, the only means of contraception that are associated with decreased risk of transmitting an STI is if you abstain, that gives you like 100% protection, or if you use condoms, which does not give you 100% protection. So again, those are all high yield things to know for the purposes of exams. And then one other weird high yield thing to keep in mind is if they give you a question about a person that gets like a prosthetic valve, right? One thing your friends at the MBME have started, you know, kind of getting interested in these days, is they will ask you questions about a person having like endocarditis after getting a prosthetic valve, right? So the thing is, you want to be able to divide that by early or late, right? So early prosthetic valve endocarditis. So you may say, oh, divine, okay, what in the world tells me that it's an early prosthetic valve endocarditis? It's 60 days. If a person has endocarditis after you put in a prosthetic valve, like within the 60-day cutoff of the surgery, the most common cause of endocarditis in those folks would be staph epidermidis, okay? If it's more than 60 days, right, then think about staph aureus, okay? I'll say that again. Early prosthetic valve endocarditis is less than 60 days after surgery. Late prosthetic valve endocarditis is more than 60 days after surgery. So the first one you want to think about, within less than 60 days, think of staph epidermidis. If it's greater than 60 days, think about staph aureus. Okay, very high yield to know that. Okay, very, very, very high yield to know that. And then if they give you an unusual situation where it's more than 12 months after they got the surgery, then the thing you want to strongly consider on your exam is strep viridans. Strep viridans, almost think of it as causing like a super late prosthetic valve endocarditis. And don't forget that if a person gets a prosthetic valve, they need anticoagulation for life. Okay? They need anticoagulation for life, usually with warfarin. Okay? In fact, many surgeons make people sign contracts so that, you know, if the valve thromboses and they die of a stroke or something, you know, it's the surgeon is kind of like not at fault or anything. Right? So that's the disadvantage of a prosthetic valve over like a bioprosthetic valve. But the thing is, the bioprosthetic valves, yeah, you don't need anticoagulation for those, but they don't last as long, right? So it's kind of like a trade-off there. Okay, so what if you get a question about like a newborn, you know, that has like a either like a clicky hip, or they can tell you that, oh, this newborn has like a leg length discrepancy, and then they may tell you that you may see like a palpable step of around the hip joint. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about like developmental dysplasia of the hip. How do you make the diagnosis, right? I mean, you can make the diagnosis. You can do like there are some physical exam maneuvers you could pursue. And sometimes you can even try to reduce the hip yourself. But, you know, if those things are not working out so well, because usually those maneuvers actually don't work very well, you know, you can go ahead and make the diagnosis with like an ultrasound. Ultrasounds are very good. Don't pick MRIs. MRIs are very expensive, right? And you probably need to sedate the kid to make that happen. So, you know, it's probably not a smart idea. And then you can put that kid in a Pavlik harness, okay? Pavlik harness is like a weird device that, you know, they kind of look like it's kind of bizarre. Look up a picture of it online, you see what I mean. So you can do an ultrasound of the hip, but if the kid is more than 6 months old, right, things have kind of ossified a little better, so the Pavlik harness may not be the best idea. So typically under those circumstances, you actually try to do like some kind of surgical reduction, and then after you do the surgical reduction, you then consider doing like a spiker cast of the kid's hip, and that will usually resolve things within a couple of weeks, 2 months. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this is like good fodder for like a question where they show you like a video on the exam and you then have to decipher what's going on there. Basically, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient kind of like walks up using his hands, walks up his knees, and they tell you that, oh, that his calves look kind of enlarged, and it's a boy. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, right? Remember Duchenne's, what are some key high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind? Well, the key high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind is that it's inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion. That's one, right? So it will not be in a girl on a test, right? It'll be in a boy, right? And then remember that these kids, right, they have mutations in dystrophin, right? So they have like no dystrophin, right? So usually many of these kids, they usually die like in their 20s. You know, if they live real long, they get the best care and everything, you know, they can live till 30, but usually kids with Duchenne's, they die relatively quickly. So that's a high yield thing to know. There's a close cousin of Duchenne's that you want to keep at the back of your mind. It's called Becker's muscular dystrophy. Some key things you want to be able to differentiate. Yes, Becker's is inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion, but unlike Duchenne's, where they have no dystrophin. Kids with Becker's, they do have some dystrophin, right? So the onset of symptoms is typically different. So usually kids with Becker's, they tend to have the onset of symptoms when they hit, like, you know, like pretty early in life. But kids with Becker's, they usually don't have an onset of symptoms up until about, like, you know, like 14, 15 years of age. So that's something high yield to know for exams. And then Becker's, again, you know, they can live to like their 50s or thereabouts before they pass away, unfortunately. And then you should also remember that kids with, they can easily give you a question and they will ask, well, how do you treat Becker's or Duchenne's muscular dystrophy? There's really no good treatment, but those people need like very good nutritional support, right? So you want to give them like very high calorie diets. You want to consider, you know, like physical therapy. You want to consider giving them corticosteroids, especially when they have like very severe symptoms. That can help. And then another weird thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that people that have Becker's or Duchenne's, actually the most common cause of death in those people is a dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay, dilated cardiomyopathies, very high yield, are the most common causes of Duchenne's and Becker's muscular dystrophy on MDME exams. And then the final thing I will say is if they give you like a Duchenne's muscular dystrophy-like presentation in a girl on your test, again, like I said, don't pick Duchenne's, don't pick Becker's. One thing you want to pick is something called LGMD, like a limb girdle muscular dystrophy. It basically presents almost identically to the muscular dystrophies, but it's inherited in like an autosomal recessive or autosomal dominant fashion. So most likely they'll ask about like, oh, autosomal inheritance on a test, because there's like a type 1, there's a type 2, but you don't need to go that deep in terms of details. But basically it's inherited in an autosomal dominant or an autosomal recessive fashion. Again, that's a high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, maybe this patient just came from South America, and then they tell you that for the past 2 months, this patient has required like multiple pillows to be able to sleep comfortably at home. And this person has like, you know, like 3+ pitting edema to the ankle, I mean, to the thighs on both, in both lower extremities. And, you know, maybe they don't give you that many more hints. What should you be thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I really hope that you're thinking about Chagas, like a Trypanosoma cruzii, right? Remember, T. cruzii can cause a lot of big problems, right? There are three big problems that it tends to cause, right? It can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? That's very high yield to know, right? And then it can cause, so they can get big hearts. They can also get big esophagus. Remember, it has a very strong association with achalasia, right? It has a very strong association with achalasia, right? So if you see a South American with achalasia, think about Trypanosoma cruzii, right? So don't forget about that. And then it can also cause like a toxic megacolon, right? So like a big esophagus, right? Because it can destroy the Auerbach plexi that you find. So they can get, I already talked about the esophagus problems. It can destroy the myenteric plexus, so like the Auerbach and Meissner's plexi. More specifically on MDME exams, it's the Auerbach plexi, like in the distal colon, and that can cause like Hirschsprung's disease, right? And if you get Hirschsprung's disease, that can certainly give rise to like a toxic megacolon. And please don't forget your other causes of a toxic megacolon on MBME exams, right? Remember C. diff, right? Especially if they give you a question about a person that has C. diff and they show you an image and the transverse colon is more than like 6 centimeters in diameter, that's bad, right? Or the person has like rebound, guardian, like abdominal rigidity and all that crap, that's toxic megacolon. And then don't forget that ulcerative colitis, right, is also associated with toxic megacolon on exams. Again, they will show you big transverse colon more than 6 centimeters. The person will have signs and symptoms of peritonitis. Those people need emergent surgery, right? That's a surgical emergency, right? They can die relatively quickly, right? So you certainly do not want that. And then one other bizarre thing that can cause toxic megacolon on exams is if a person has like scleroderma and they have like bacterial overgrowth, that can ultimately lead to a toxic megacolon as well. Those are all, again, high yield things that your friends at the MBME love to test on exams. And then the way you treat T. cruzii, right? Because it's like it's a protozoan, right? You know, you can treat, it kind of works like the worms, right? So remember, worms are bendy, so you can treat it with bendazoles, right? So you can use a drug like benznidazole, so benznidazole, benznidazole is actually the first line medication for the treatment of Trypanosoma cruzii. And then if you don't see that as an answer choice, you can pick a drug known as nifurtimox. Nifurtimox is spelled nifurtimox. I'll spell that again. Nifurtimox. Nifurtimox. Okay. Nifurtimox is the drug of, is a second line drug for treating Chagas disease from Trypanosoma cruzi. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of like bipolar disorder, and then this patient starts having tremors, maybe this patient has seizures and all that badness, and I don't know, maybe they also have like, you know, like really bad hyponatremia, really bad hypernatremia. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about lithium toxicity, right? Remember, lithium can cause many problems, right? So lithium can cause like nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. I've said this ad nauseum in many podcasts. This is probably the concept that I've talked the most about across my different podcasts, because it's just high over. It's just one of those things, you know, you're going to see it on an exam, right? So lithium can cause nephrogenic DI because, again, remember, it uses that INEC channel that we find at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct to go and screw up the second messenger signaling cascade of ADH, right? So it can cause nephrogenic DI. And remember, you treat that with an INEC channel blocker like amiloride or triamterene. I've talked about the mechanism and the reasoning behind that ad nauseum, so I'm going to move on. And then remember that lithium can also cause hypothyroidism, right? So before you start a person on lithium, you typically want to go ahead and check like their TSH, right? Just to make sure that they have adequate thyroid function. And then remember that lithium can also cause like Epstein's anomaly, where you almost like have like, it basically causes a right heart failure. You have like this, the buzzword is like atrialization of the right ventricle. That's something high you ought to know. And then the most common toxicity of lithium is the tremors. But lithium can also cause seizures, especially when you have lithium at like super therapeutic levels. It can cause seizures, right? So because it can cause seizures, if a person is seizing from lithium use, one thing you should strongly consider doing is going ahead and like, you know, like put in, there's this thing they call the Gambro. It's done a ton in the ICU. Basically, it's like a dialysis catheter, and then you try to get like emergent dialysis done. You insert the Gambro in like a central vein, like in the like one of the jugular veins. It actually works pretty well. But yes, if a person is like seizing and all that real badness from lithium toxicity, you know, you should strongly consider dialyzing those people to get rid of the toxic lithium. And since I talked about hypernatremia, this idea just kind of came into my mind. It's something that, again, your friends at the MME seem to care about relatively recently. But the thing is, this drug that is used to promote like contractions, like oxytocin can actually cause like hyponatremic seizures. So that's one thing you need to watch out for. It's just a throwback to a step one concept, right? So because remember, right, ADH and oxytocin, I think they differ by like two amino acids, and they come from the same general area in the hypothalamus, right? Remember, the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus makes ADH. The paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus makes oxytocin. But there's actually a lot of research that actually shows that some cells in the supraoptic nuclei of the hypothalamus also make oxytocin, right? So the thing is, if you give a person ADH, works by basically making you reclaim resorb a ton of water, right, through binding to like the vasopressin V2 receptors, and then you stick all those aquaporins at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, right? So the thing is, if a person gets like a prolonged oxytocin infusion, that can certainly cause like a hyponatremic seizure, right? Because that oxytocin is essentially taking the place of ADH, right? So because it's taking the place of ADH, those people can run into significant problems with hyponatremia. That is something you absolutely want to commit to memory for MBM exams. It's a very common concept that shows up all the time on tests, right? So again, that is something super, super high yield you want to make sure that you know. Because again, like I said, oxytocin can act like ADH. So let me even talk about another look-alike molecule style question you see on a test, right? So remember that cortisol, right, has partial activity on mineralocorticoid receptors. So usually when people have Cushing's syndrome, right, they will have like many of the labs that you would expect in a person that has primary hyperaldosteronism. So, you know, they'll be hypertensive, they'll have like a hypokalemia, they'll have a metabolic alkalosis and all that stuff, right? So that's something to watch out for. Another area you may see those kinds of symptoms is if a person has like 11-beta hydroxylase deficiency. Remember, in 11-beta hydroxylase deficiency, one key thing that builds up is that's one of the causes of the congenital adrenal hyperplasias. One key thing that builds up is something known as 11-deoxycorticosterone. The thing with 11-deoxycorticosterone is that it has partial agonist activity on mineralocorticoid receptors, right? So under those circumstances, you could actually see people get, hypokalemia, metabolic alkalosis, and hypertension under those circumstances. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, gets like a vascular procedure, right? Like a recent vascular procedure, maybe like a central line was inserted or something, and then this patient starts having shortness of breath, has like jugular venous distension. They tell you that, oh, you auscultate the person's lungs, and on one side you don't hear any breath sounds and blah 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 blah, and the patient's gasping for air. If you see that, what should you think about? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking more along the lines of like a pneumothorax, right? Probably like a tension pneumothorax. And if a person has a tension pneumo, because they've probably punctured the lung in the process of doing those vascular procedures. Remember, if a person has a tension pneumothorax, you want to consider doing like a needle decompression. Although one thing your friends at the MMA can do too is, instead of calling it a needle decompression, they can just give it another name. Remember, a needle decompression can also be known as a needle thoracostomy. Okay, needle thoracostomy, right? So that's one thing you can absolutely do on an exam, right? So again, something to keep at the back of your mind. And then if a person has like just, you know, like a regular pneumothorax, you can insert a chest tube, right? But again, instead of putting the name chest tube, they can put like the term tube thoracostomy on your exam. Okay, so remember, needle decompression can also be called needle thoracostomy. Chest tube placement can also be called tube thoracostomy. You do a needle thoracostomy when a person has a tension pneumothorax. And then one other, I guess, complication that can arise when you're, you know, doing vascular procedures is a person can get like an air embolus, right? Person can get an air embolus, and that thing can actually kill people relatively quickly. It's almost kind of like the pathophysiology, very similar, like deleterious effects as like a person that has like Caisson's disease, for example, like the bends, where, you know, like gases can precipitate in a blood vessel and can kill them relatively quickly. So the thing you usually do under those circumstances is that if you suspect air embolism, usually they'll give you a question and the person's lungs will sound fine, right, to basically tell you that it's not a pneumothorax. Whenever you see those kinds of situations, the thing you absolutely want to think about on your test is just to consider giving those, telling those people to turn to the left lateral decubitus position. When they turn in the left lateral decubitus position, the thing that happens is you're essentially taking advantage of the effects of gravity, so that the air does not go to the right side of the heart and then doesn't ultimately settle and go to like the pulmonary arteries and then cause like a nasty PE, right? So you don't want that, right? So, you know, you tell the person, lie on your left side. So that's like the left lateral decubitus position. And you also put them in like Trendelenburg, again, to prevent the air embolus essentially from getting to the right side of the heart, so that they don't get into trouble. And then I think I may have mentioned a podcast or two, but I can't really remember, so I'm just going to talk about it, right? So what are the two genetic mechanisms behind Down syndrome? What is probably the most common genetic mechanism underlying Down syndrome? Right, it's maternal non-disjunction, right? That's why, again, as women get up there in age, you know, they have a higher risk of having kids with Downs, right? And then what is the second common mechanism that tends to show up on exams? Probably causes like less than 5% of cases of Downs. Well, that's a Robertsonian translocation, right? That's a Robertsonian translocation. The thing is, these genetic mechanisms that underlie certain genetic diseases or certain diseases, there are things your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know, right? So you see the way we've kind of talked about how, like Down syndrome, you can have like the maternal non-disjunction or the Robertsonian translocation. For things like Prader-Willi, Angelman syndromes, right? Remember, those are associated with uniparental disomy, genetic imprinting kind of deal, right? So those are, again, all key things to keep at the back of your mind. And then Down syndrome, right? Let's not forget the associations, right? So remember, they can have like cardiac problems, like endocardial cushion defects. They can have a lot of GI problems. They can have like Hirschsprung's disease. You can see like the bilious vomiting in a newborn, like double bubble, duodenal atresia. They could have like annular pancreas, right? That can also cause a small bowel obstruction like thingy. But that will not be in a newborn. That will likely be like in a kid that's, you know, kind of live for a while with Down syndrome. They can also have like ALL, right? Remember that mnemonic, they all fall down, right? So ALL is common in kids with Downs. And remember that because they have three copies of chromosome 21, right? So like trisomy 21, you can make the diagnosis with like karyotyping. But another thing is they have like three copies of the amyloid precursor protein, right? So those kids have a very high risk of early onset Alzheimer's. So again, those are all important things you want to keep at the back of your mind on tests. Okay, now, one other idea actually just dropped in my mind with Downs, right? So don't forget your quad screen results with Downs. We really love to test this all the time on exams. Basically, it's like they have like high levels of beta HCG and inhibin A, right? And then every other thing is low, like their AFP and their fetal estriol is low, right? And then the way I remember that is I just remember like high beta, like HI beta, right? So high beta, right? So if you remember like high beta, then you can remember that, oh, beta HCG is high, inhibin A is high as well in those people. And then AFP estriol, those are low. So those are important to know. And then what is one other high yield thing? Yeah, Edwards syndrome, right? So trisomy 18. Basically everything is low in those people. Yeah, Edwards is bad. Like they're pretty much everything in those people for the most part is low. You know, one or more things may be normal, but basically if you see like three things that are low in the quad screen, that's Edwards syndrome, trisomy 18 on your exam. Trisomy 13, the results are all over the place, so they don't test that on exams. And then remember, if you have any kind of neurotube defect, right, or you have like an abdominal wall defect like gastroschisis or omphalocele, right, that's like an abdominal wall defect, those can all cause elevations in maternal serum alpha fetoprotein. So again, key things to keep in mind for exams. Now, to wrap up, right, so what are the two kinds of hernias that you don't watch and wait? What are the two kinds of hernias where you notice them, you fix them, you know, relatively quickly? Well, I hope you're thinking about like a paraesophageal hernia, right, and also a femoral hernia, right? Paraesophageal hernias, femoral hernias. Femoral hernias will not be in males, they'll be in females. Remember the F in femoral for the F in female, okay? So they'll show up in females on exams, right, and they'll be below the inguinal ligament. They'll usually be like medial to like the femoral vessels, right? So whenever you see that, you know, you don't want to go ahead and consider surgery because those have a, you know, pretty high risk of like incarceration and strangulation. And again, those are all things your friends at the MBME really care that you know for exams. Okay, now, I think maybe I should go ahead and stop here. Let me give you like one last vignette. This one just kind of popped in my mind. So what if they give you a question about a person? Maybe this person, I don't know, saw an armadillo recently or farms like works with monkeys or came from like a foreign country where they may have contacted like strange animals, and then they have like they have loss of sensation over like the tip of the nose, over the tips of the fingers, or they may have like these weird swellings on their faces, like dysmorphic facial features. What bug are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I really hope you're thinking about leprosy, right? Leprosy, Mycobacterium leprae. Leprosy is bad, right? But the thing is, it loves to affect like cold regions of a person's body, right? Cold regions of a person's body. And in terms of treatment, don't forget, like the way I remember it is like DRC, like Democratic Republic of Congo. That can help you remember like the way you treat it. And the treatment is actually for 2 years. So you may say, oh, divine, what in the world does DRC mean? Well, the D stands for Dapsone, right? The R stands for Rifampin. And then the C stands for Clofazimine. I'll say that again, Dapsone, Rifampin, and Clofazimine. Okay, for 24 months, right? So leprosy is something you don't want to get. So, you know, if you see like a 9-banded armadillo, it's probably not a good idea to like, oh, go chill, rub the armadillo. I mean, you may be rubbing yourself with some good old leprosy as well, which, you know, is probably not an ideal thing. I mean, leprosy, treatment for 2 years, if you can, just don't get leprosy if you can avoid it. It's a bad thing to have. Okay, because you can have like permanent nerve damage that, you know, you never recover. Okay, now, and really the way you make the diagnosis, really for the most part, you just do like a biopsy and you should be fine. Like, you know, just find one of those areas that it's affected, do a biopsy, and you can usually like, you know, stain and find the Mycobacterium leprae. So yeah, I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, basically if you need tutoring and you're in med school, I probably offer something that can help you out. So step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for like the in-training exam or the ABIM board exam, or you're a college student and you need tutoring for like Gen Chem, OChem, physics, biochem, histology, physiology, I do offer tutoring for all those things, one-on-one, large group. And then I also do like these booster courses. It's like 20 hours for step one, and it's 10 hours for step 2 CK, step 3. They are like very rapid review courses. We talk about the must-knows for these exams. And pretty much everyone I've done those courses with, they have ended up doing extremely well on the exams. They found it to be very helpful. Like many people have recorded some pretty decent score increases from that. And usually this course goes for like a week. Although I guess it kind of depends on your own timing, but usually it runs for like a week for the set number of hours, as I mentioned. And then I also do like large group sessions. In fact, this is something I plan to offer in the month of February, March, April, and May. So February, March, April, and May. Basically, they are like detailed, comprehensive USMLE courses where it will run for about 100 hours. It will run over a couple of weeks. It probably will run for like a month or less. So if you have a group of 7 people that need tutoring for the USMLE Step 1 exam or Step 2 CK or Step 3, if you can arrange a group, again, just reach out to me. You can either reach out to me through the website or you send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com, right? And I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. So that's one thing I offer. And then the final thing I offer is if you need like coaching for like if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, right? You can do, like if you need like one-on-one coaching for like rec letters, personal statements, mock interviews, editing applications. Again, I've worked with tons of people. Most of the people I've worked with, they've matched at their first choices. So again, if you need any of those things, reach out to me. Probably make a podcast soon on like the different course offerings I have. That's something that people have kind of asked me about. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you next time. Good night. God bless you. Thank you. And actually, one thing I shouldn't forget, my YouTube channel, I'm going to be posting a lot of videos to that like over the next couple of days to weeks. So please subscribe. It's called Divine Intervention Podcasts and Videos. I'd like to hit 1,000 subscribers hopefully before the end of the month. I'm at almost like 670. So please subscribe. Tell your friends. Share at your med schools. Okay. Well, I guess all I'll say. This has gone on for 32 minutes now. God bless you. I'll see you in episode 200.